Chapter 11, The Great Shame. Much good happened during John Paul's reign. The Catholic Church grew in Africa and in South and Central America, and the number of Catholics in the world grew to more than 1.1 billion. The Church, more than ever, came to seem a refuge for the poor and the weak, for the immigrant and the oppressed. This was a very beautiful thing to see, and it reflected John Paul's beloved Beatitudes. Blessed are the hungry, the humble. John Paul was an evangelist who brought the message of the Bible to more than 120 countries. This pilgrim pope brought Christian witness to an unbelieving age, and this too was beautiful, for it returned the Church to its essential and evangelical roots. Saint Peter walked in sandals telling the world of Christ. John Paul brought the word on Shepherd One. He canonized 482 saints, more than all the popes in the previous 400 years combined. And they were a diverse lot, as saints are. Among them, Edith Stein, a Jewish convert who had become a Carmelite nun and who died in the gas chambers of Auschwitz. When told she might escape death by proclaiming her Catholicism, she said she should gain no advantage from her baptism. She said, "If I cannot share the lot of my brothers and sisters, my life, in a certain sense, is destroyed." At her canonization mass, which was attended by hundreds of thousands of people, John Paul said her life teaches us something we must know to live. Quote, "Do not accept anything as the truth if it lacks love, and do not accept anything as love which lacks truth." And there was the Polish priest, Maximilian Kolbe, who also died in the gas chambers and was canonized by John Paul. The young father, whom Kolbe saved by taking his place in a starvation bunker, was an old man now, but he came to Rome to take part in the celebrations and give witness to a heroic life. John Paul also beatified 1,338 people, again more than all the popes combined in the previous 400 years. In one case, so eager was the pope to honor heroic virtue, he gave the title Venerable to speed along the canonization process. Venerable Pierre Toussaint, born into a Haitian slave family in late 18th century Haiti, was brought to New York by his owner. The man died. His widow, left penniless, collapsed. And with the generosity of a saint, Pierre Toussaint now quietly began to support her. These people, the man and the woman, had taught him a trade. He was a hairdresser. Pierre Toussaint went out and made himself the most fashionable and personally admired hairstylist in 19th century Manhattan. Among his clients and friends were the wife of Alexander Hamilton. Pierre Toussaint never let his owner know the extent of his assistance to her because he didn't want her to feel humiliated. When she freed him, he bought the freedom of other slaves. He became a renowned philanthropist and an ardent man of God who walked to Mass every day for 60 years. Carriage drivers in those days would not stop for blacks. He became a force behind the building of Old St. Patrick's Church in downtown Manhattan, a beautiful church that is still there. During a yellow fever epidemic, Pierre Toussaint did not flee the city, as just about everybody else did, all his clients did. He stayed behind instead, and he risked his life to help the sick and dying. He took in the abandoned. He fed hungry children, black and white. He didn't care what color they were. He felt a special tenderness, however, toward orphans. When he died, at the age of 87, it was front page news in New York. He was buried at Old St. Patrick's, which was overwhelmed by the thousands of people he'd helped. A century and a half later, New York's Cardinal O'Connor asked that Pierre Troussant's remains be transferred to St. Patrick's Cathedral, where they have an honored place in a crypt under the altar. Troussant is the only layman ever to receive this honor. The cause for Pierre Troussant's beatification continues. A miracle is needed. But John Paul kept an eye on his case, and when he last visited New York, he said of Pierre Troussant, "What is so extraordinary about this man? He radiated a most serene and joyful faith, nourished daily by the Eucharist and visits to the Blessed Sacrament. In the face of constant, painful discrimination, he understood, as few have understood, the meaning of the words, 'Father, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing.'" "No treasure," said the Pope, "is as uplifting and transforming as the light of faith." So John Paul was elevating all of these men and women, making them saints, making them beatified or venerated. He was doing this because it was a great teaching moment. It was a way of reaching people alive in the world today. It was a way of saying to them, "See what a great life is. See how it fills and lights the world, even when that life is over. Emulate that life. Learn from it." John Paul was valiant and eloquent in his long battle for the right of all to live, and his fierce resistance to the governments of the West as they moved to push on the materially poor of other countries population controls, including artificial contraception and abortion. John Paul reached out to the world's Jews, visiting the Great Synagogue of Rome in April of 1986, and asking that Christian-Jewish dialogue become more deeply theological. After all, Christianity's roots are Jewish roots, and Christianity's founders read the Hebrew Bible. We have much to understand and ponder as we consider the mystery of our shared roots and our continuing redemption. In the year 2000, during the Church's Great Jubilee year, John Paul decided that at the heart of the celebrations would be a day of penance and pardon, a day in which the Church would ask for forgiveness for its historical sins. The Church admitted bad actions, from the depredations of the Crusades to the horrors of the Holocaust. And John Paul was blunt. He said, "In certain periods of history, Christians have at times given in to intolerance and have not been faithful to the great commandment of love, sullying in this way the faith of the Church." And then he humbly asked forgiveness for the Church and its people. What I write here only touches on some of the most obvious achievements of his papacy, but there were mistakes too, of course, for John Paul was human and his reign was long. One mistake, in my view at least, is that he did not move forcefully against the embarrassment of how the Mass is celebrated in the West. I speak here of the flattening and dulling of Scripture, which is so pervasive that a priest told me recently that saying the flat, ungainly words of Catholic rites is like chewing cardboard. The forgetting or denial of transcendent music and language, the seeming banishment of transcendence itself. In the last 30 years, the Church has made what was beautiful banal. And there's also been a pervasive dumbing down, priests who barely know the precepts of their faith and can barely teach them. I think the two generations of daffy implementers of Vatican II did this. And John Paul, in my view, seems to have turned his head a bit. It is ironic that the Western Church, particularly the American Church, is, in my view, essentially unprepared for the first influx of seekers and potential converts that has begun knocking on the Church's door since the extraordinary funeral mass of John Paul. These are people who watched a week of live coverage from Rome. They saw the heightened mass. They heard the deep truths of the homily. They saw the dignity and transcendence of the Church of Rome. They heard the sacred music and the smells and the bells. This is what they must have it in their heads that they can come and join in America. But what they're going to get when they enter a church next Sunday in New Jersey is an old priest sort of scratching himself distractedly throughout an irrelevant homily, and a woman with a thin voice singing tunelessly as she strums a guitar. Oh God, I wish every Mass could be a banjo-free zone. It is all so embarrassing. And yet there is a miracle in it. People really do come to Mass these days in spite of it. What has been done to the Mass has largely been done in the past 30 years, which is to say, on John Paul's watch. Was it his fault? No. Destruction like this comes from 10,000 priests making 10,000 decisions each day. But could he have done more? Yes, I think so. Should he have? Yes, I do believe so. And there was one other mistake. It is more famous, it isn't over, and one suspects its root cause is not unconnected to the damage done to the Mass. John Paul was not famous as a gifted administrator, and he did not spend his time attempting to become an especially sophisticated bureaucrat. It has long been observed that at the beginning of his papacy, he felt he had to choose between attempting to control the Curia, the vast bureaucracy that runs the Vatican, and reaching out to the world. He famously chose the latter, and it would be very hard to conclude, especially since he took the papacy at roughly the beginning of the mass media age, it would be very hard to conclude that his decision was wrong. Because he stood unwaveringly for church teaching, he was often called a hardliner, but he was hardly that. His approach was generally not strict, but expansive. His focus was the planet. But in leadership, every decision to move forward here is a decision not to move forward there, and there may suffer. The Pope is not a policeman or a prosecutor. He is not a CEO or a general, nor is he the local DA. He cannot exert immediate and specific control on all aspects and actors of the Church. He can't direct the actions of the Church in every nation on the earth. But the sex scandals that swept the Catholic Church in America during his reign are, inescapably in my view, part of his legacy, and obviously the unhappiest portion. They are part of what he left behind, part of what his successor will have to deal with. They are, these scandals, the great shame of the modern American Church. They did not begin under John Paul's reign, but they grew in scope and number during his tenure. By 2003, some 1,200 Catholic priests in America had been accused of sexual abuse. In the Archdiocese of Boston alone, the Massachusetts Attorney General announced that up to 1,000 children had been sexually molested by Catholic priests. By that year, 10 American church leaders had resigned, and hundreds of court cases had been brought against the church, which threatened to bankrupt a number of archdioceses. It is the gravest tragedy in the history of the American church. The scandals had been growing for decades. All the court records suggest it picked up speed in the mid-1960s. Before then, the majority of priests in America who were destructive seemed most often to focus their destructive power on themselves. They were lost souls or whiskey priests or men who'd lost their faith, and they were captured in fiction by, among others, Willa Cather and Graham Greene and Edwin O'Connor. They were painted as men who thought that they were failures, and yet they were not failures. They were just human. They were men of God who had fallen into this pit or that. They struggled. But the destructive priests who followed them did not confine their damage to themselves. They included among their victims children, parents, families. They included whole neighborhoods and parishes, and they encompassed generations. Anyone within the church, sophisticated about the church, privy to its long-standing problems, and that would be just about all of America's current Catholic Church leaders, could see the tsunami of woe building and coming, and could conclude that when it hit, it would capsize the dwellings and lives of the most modest. I have been struck, reading and researching the scandals, by the number of teenage boys molested and seduced by priests who came from single-parent families, often their mothers, hoping for some kind of stability and hoping for the influence of a man for their sons to emulate, pressed their confused 11-year-olds and 13-year-olds to become altar boys for Father Bill or to go on fishing trips with Father Joe. They hoped the priests would serve as role models. And instead, so many of them were predators who felt free to do what they wanted because there was no man in the house to whom they might have to answer. There was only a mother blinded by trust. Some cases are still very famous, of course. Many of the earlier cases were centered on the Boston Archdiocese, headed by Cardinal Bernard Law. Among the most well-known was that of Father Paul Shanley, who had a history of sexual abuse against boys dating back to 1966, and who ultimately was charged with abusing boys aged 6 to 15 during the period between 1979 and 1989. There was the case of the Reverend John Gagan, charged with sexually molesting scores of boys and girls. His case was settled by the Archdiocese of Boston for a reported $10 million. And there was the case of Father Daniel Graham, accused of many separate cases of sexual misconduct, who admitted to the sexual abuse of children, but who was then allowed by cardinal law to continue in ministry in Quincy, Massachusetts, where the parishioners were not told of his background. Informing parishes that their new priest was a child molester was not church policy until the late 1990s. The scandals, of course, did not take place only or primarily in the Boston Archdiocese. They occurred all over the country, and perhaps their iconic moment is the Palm Beach story. In the late 1990s, the Bishop of Palm Beach was revealed to have sexually molested several minors. A new bishop was sent in to take his place. He was Bishop Anthony O'Connell, who for almost 20 years had run a high school seminary in Missouri. When Bishop O'Connell was installed in Palm Beach, he signed a statement that ringingly and appropriately condemned the priestly sexual abuses that were cropping up throughout the church at that point. The statement he signed was seen by a man who years before had been one of Bishop O'Connell's high school seminary students, and whom O'Connell had sexually molested. The man came forward and told his story. Bishop O'Connell admitted it, more or less, but then, in a full statement to the press, he suggested that his sexual relationship with the boy was meant as, quote, therapy, and that this was all the fault of the 1970s, that the church then was in the thrall of Masters and Johnson, and that his greatest sin may have been an excess of altruistic zeal. He said, "I've always been a do-gooder." He then suggested that actually this whole mess was pretty much the fault of John Paul II for appointing him. William F. Buckley, no radical on the issue of priestly sexual abuse, who has tried to be both patient and truthful in his writings on the problem, did a column in which he noted that Bishop O'Connell, at his news conference, had asked for prayers for those who supported him. And then the bishop added that he would ask those who were angry at him to, quote, pray for my forgiveness. This was a bit too much for William Buckley. After reporting it, he noted that he had received a note from his brother Jim about the scandal. Jim Buckley, James Buckley, the former United States Senator from New York and a federal judge, had written to Bill Buckley, "This is an occasion where a papal apology is truly appropriate." Jim Buckley advised the church explain that while it continues always to love the sinner and hope for reformation and salvation, its overarching responsibility to the faithful requires it, quote, to defrock or otherwise isolate any priest who is guilty of sexual abuse. Well, who could disagree? As the scandals broke and became more famous, people would ask me for my reaction. I was at first taken aback like everybody else, and then I was angry like everyone else, and in time I felt true anguish. People began to ask me if the scandals had shaken my faith, and this startled me. I was mad at the hierarchy. I was mad at cardinals and priests, but it didn't. None of this could shake my belief. How could it? That doesn't come from priests. It isn't bestowed by them. How could all this have happened? There are many answers, many answerers. One that seemed to me wise and that captured at least a portion of the problem came from an old Monsignor. In the summer of 2003, feeling an anger that had become fury at what so many priests had done, I sought the old Monsignor out. I told him I felt swept by resentment, and I wanted to admit it, air it, get rid of it, refresh. The Monsignor looked down at the floor and said he not only understood, he shared all of my feelings. "It is also disappointing," he said. But he thought there was a reason it had happened in America. He said, I should note he is an immigrant who came to America 25 years ago. He said, "We love our country, America, but our priests come from our country and from our time. They come from us. They are of us. And you know, there is no one American people. We are many people from many places, and we are proud of this. We have all the talent of the world, but we have all the sickness of the world, too. All the sickness of the world is here." In his detailed and informed appreciation of John Paul, called Man of the Century, published in 1997, the journalist and historian Jonathan Quitney tells this story. In 1992, a brave young Catholic journalist, Jason Berry, wrote a book called Lead Us Not Into Temptation, Catholic Priests and the Sexual Abuse of Children. It was an indictment of predatory priests and the higher-ups who covered up their crimes. Berry reported that for years the Vatican Embassy in Washington had received almost weekly reports of priests who had molested the young. The church had already paid $400 million in legal settlements. Berry not only detailed case after case of priests who had sexually molested grade school boys and teenagers, he got his hand on videotapes the priests themselves had taken and were selling. The Berry book was followed by a 60-minute report. Father Thomas Doyle, a canon lawyer, said in that report that an estimated 3,000 of the 50,000 U.S. priests had abused minors. Finally, a delegation of U.S. bishops went to Rome. They asked for the right to make, quote, summary judgments to remove priests who had abused children. But John Paul, as Quitney reports it, would not agree. John Paul feared witch hunts, false charges, unjust oppression, all of which he had seen under Nazism and communism. The bishops said they feared financial disaster from the lawsuits. John Paul acknowledged pain for the victims, but he also called for compassion, and he warned against sensationalism. and apparently pointed a finger at the mass media. So, while the American church hierarchy did a lot that was wrong, it did not, according to Whitney's book at least, receive sufficient help and guidance from the Vatican when it was at last trying to set things right. Why did John Paul fail to respond adequately in this area? Again, there are as many answers as there are answerers. Some say the scandals were not his fault. He tried to lead the American church towards sanctity, but many of its members, distracted by politics and ideology and conceit and going their own way in the day-to-day, many of them did not and would not listen. Some say John Paul did not respond adequately because by the time the problem reached its height, he was too old and too sick to move decisively. Some believe the old man in the Vatican was not consistently given a true, clear picture of the size and scope of the tragedy. My view is that there is no doubt some truth in all of this, but there is some truth, too, in this. John Paul was a Pole of another era who could not imagine, who had no category for, the idea of Catholic priests operating in a kind of protection racket in which they serially molest teenage boys and their superiors engage in a systematic cover-up. The Poland in which John Paul came of age was a country in which both men and women worshipped. Unlike the Irish and the Italians, the men in Poland didn't leave worship to the women. They worshipped right along with them. John Paul experienced the priesthood, and he witnessed the priesthood each day as a manly and masculine institution. The Pope himself was a hero who had inspired hundreds of young men and women to live lives of heroic virtue in the priesthood and also for women in the convent. I suspect the very heroism of the Pope's life, the heroism that his life demanded in facing communism, atheism, Nazism, paganism, the culture of death, materialism, all that, all those isms, the very heroism he had to have tended to blind him to the new menace. The idea of broad, deep sexual decadence infecting the American church, how could that be? How could that be a great struggle? John Paul saw his fellow Polish priests fight to feed people and hide them from the Gestapo and get them out of the clutches of the commissar. His very conception of the priesthood was a noble band of brothers. The priests he knew and lived among were great men. He would have thought sin, including sexual sin, is part of human life. And priests are human beings. They are not virtue machines. They are men, and sometimes, by definition, they fail. But widespread sexual incontinence and predation, and a church that knowingly covered it up and reassigned priests they knew to be serial offenders, endangering more children? That must have seemed impossible. That was not within the categories of known human behavior for John Paul II. The old Pole could not fully imagine the depth and breadth of the American scandal, and with a background like his, how could he? Nor was he correct that the American media sensationalized the charges or promoted them out of animus toward the church. I know this in many ways, and one is firsthand. When, in the mid-1990s, I began to understand what was happening in the church, I went to people in the media who were my friends, and I told them this was a growing story. I asked them to go after it. They were always interested, and it's interesting to me that they were rarely surprised by what I was saying. But they also let me know, one way or another, that this was just not the sort of material networks and newspapers really like to go after. For one thing, the reporting necessary to do the job, to do it correctly is extremely time-consuming. It involves lengthy, labor-intensive, and very expensive investigation. And then, if you're lucky enough to get the story and run it, you open yourself to charges of left-wing media bias. You know, people will say to you, you hate the church, you want to hurt it. Just as important, such media reports tended to rouse the resentment of America's Catholics, and there are more than 50 million Catholic consumers of the news in America. Networks don't want to anger them unless they have to. News shows and news magazines did feature stories now and then about this abusing priest and that abusing bishop, but they were at least 20 years late in reporting the true scope and size and depth of this scandal. Not until the Boston Globe blew the lid in 2002 with a long and exhaustive series that revealed the persistent shuffling of guilty priests from diocese to diocese in the Boston Archdiocese, allowing those priests to commit crime after crime. Not until then did things begin to change. The Boston Globe won a Pulitzer Prize, and they deserved it.